Hello, people, and welcome to the Majlis. This is a weekly current affairs podcast of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis, and I also handle Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, South and Central Asia affairs here in Washington, D.C. So it's again that time when we revisit Uzbekistan's cotton fields for a quick reality check. And this year, it's particularly important because there has been lots of promises by the authorities to eradicate forced labor from Uzbekistan's cotton fields. And there has been claims and counterclaims since on how did this go. And we tried to bring on Uzbek authorities to join us on the show like we did in our previous shows on cotton, but it didn't work out for them. However, in the absence of the authorities, we have the best panel possible to discuss this issue. So let's get into it. Joining me from Tashkent is Yunus Astrup, International Labour Organization's Chief Technical Advisor in Uzbekistan, Umida Niyazova, Director of Uzbek-German Forum for Human Rights, the organization which closely monitors Uzbekistan's cotton fields, Laziz Omilov, journalist with the RFRL's Uzbek service, where he runs a reporting project on Uzbekistan's cotton fields called Paxtagram, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today.
Thank you.
So let me kick off the debate with a general question. Then I would like to focus on really a reality check points one by one so that we address all those points being discussed currently. So let me start with Yunus, with you. How things look like in the cotton fields of Uzbekistan as we speak? Is the harvest complete? Near complete? What's the stats of harvest?
The 2019 cotton harvest is ongoing. So right now in Uzbekistan, the world's largest labor effort is underway. So we at the ILO are not aware of any other event in the world where approximately 2.5 million people are recruited for a single event like it is the case for the cotton harvest in Uzbekistan. So these are very interesting times. The harvest is ongoing. It is a bit too early to draw conclusions about the trends of the harvest. We are keeping an open mind, and we are in the process of gathering data, both quantitative and qualitative. And I would also like to stress that it is particularly at the final stage of the harvest where it is particularly important to pay attention, because that is where the risks of forced labor are highest.
Okay.
But yes, the harvest is ongoing, and a few observations that I can share with you that I hear back from our monitors in the field. We have 20 monitors.
Yunus, can we do that a little bit later? I have all those points to be discussed in details. Umida, you have lots of monitors there on the ground. So what is your reports about the harvest? How things are compared to the last year?
The cotton harvest is in full swing, yes, and it's too early to come with the conclusion. I can just share with some information which I receive every day from our monitors, from social networks, from independent media. And there are about 50 organizations on my list that possibly send their workers to pick cotton or force them to pay for hired pickers. There are several documents about forcing workers to pick cotton from this year. For example, following the order of Minister for Emergency, the fire services in different regions sent 2,100 of its employees to pick cotton in Jizak region. And yeah, firefighters they from different regions, they wrote letters to, I saw they posted on Ozot League saying that it was compulsory for them, and they thought, they expected that the prohibition of forced labor, which was widely reported in the local media, should also apply to them. And probably you saw also that there was a video which distributed online where police officers were also complaining that the harvest is compulsory for them. So there are cadets from Academy of Minister of Internal Affairs who forcibly sent to pick cotton again in Jizak region. It's too early to say like how many people had been forced.
Okay. I hear that both of you, Umida and Yunus, saying that it's too early to provide any conclusive remarks on that. But as far as Umida, you were talking about is like it kind of very much familiar from the last discussion where we discussed continued forced labor, problem with the monitoring and therefore reporting errors, conditions of the accommodations where people were deployed, and intimidations of bloggers and journalists journalists who you just reported about on your website, Omida. So let me bring in Laziz, you here. So did anything change in the way you see it in terms of the practices, the way this thing is handled this year so far?
Well, let me tell you that we also keep receiving the reports from different regions, and the cotton season is still going on. And as Umida said, a lot of budget employees, a lot of state employees are being forcibly sent to pick cotton, including firefighters, police officers, national guards. Yes, well, the pattern is a little bit different, I would say, because it looks more secret. We keep receiving reports from people that they are pressured a lot not to talk about this much, and but thanks to digital media and so on, now we are receiving the explicit videos, especially surprisingly even from police officers and these kind of organizations, where they are openly refusing to go to pick cotton. And this is the surprising part, because before we have never received the videos where police is talking about forcibly being sent to cotton fields. Also, like every year, cotton policy and cotton season is leading to victims of this policy.
Let's talk about that a little bit later. I just want to focus on the forced labor aspect of this. Laziz was talking about, Yunus, about the methods, and you mentioned some metrics like 2.5 million people. How is it compared to the last year, the method and the number?
First of all, I'd like to echo what Laziz is saying. We are also seeing an increase in the openness from both pickers and farmers during our monitoring. We see a willingness to share information, but we also see a willingness to complain in a way that is significantly different from previous years. And I think this is a positive thing, that people are willing to speak openly about this, to speak up and to complain. I think this is a result of the awareness raising, of the increased media coverage and the discussions here in Uzbekistan. So it is ultimately a positive sign.
Yunus, Laziz was saying like the process become a little bit secretive. Do you see any change in the method, the way it's handled this year?
No, I mean, I can tell you we have free and full access to do whatever we want to do. I don't see any attempts to hide anything. We work with local human rights activists as part of the monitoring this year. They report that they are free to do the monitoring, and they don't feel that anything is being hidden from them. On the contrary, I find that there's an increased openness. Okay. Not only from the authorities, but also from pickers and farmers.
Okay. Umida, talking about the inclusion of activists in the monitoring process so far, how it is measured, where you stand in terms of the openness of the authorities, the way this process is taking place this year? I mean, are your monitors able to go on the ground to monitor or do what they're supposed to do there?
Yeah, many of our monitors, they're working undercover. So they go to the fields as a cotton pickers, or they go to the organizations, offer themselves as a cotton pickers, and they do go to the fields and pick cotton. And
why they go undercover? I mean, is there anything wrong to be openly monitoring this?
Yeah, absolutely, because people are instructed not to tell that, for example, they are employees of the organization. So especially this is what I wanted to point, that yes, this year the methods are different, that Hakims, heads of the district, they're trying to hide the compulsory mobilization. For example, our monitor saying that some of them are farmers. They said that when they go to the night meeting at the Hakimiyat, so they have to leave their phones. So there is no possibility, for example, to record anything from that meetings. For example, last year there was a meetings when it was openly said that like certain number of employees must go to pick cotton, but this year people are receiving an order to go to pick cotton, but not as publicly as it was before.
Wow, that's interesting. Yunus, why is that? I mean, is there anything that you would like to...
Look, it's interesting. And I think it's really important to distinguish between forced labor and sort of corruption, quite frankly. And one of the things that we see, and it may help to explain what Umida is describing. So one of the things that we see continue to be a problem is request for payment from people for replacement pickers, from people who don't want to pick cotton themselves. So there is a...
Explain that, Jonas, please. What's that?
So basically, it means that you're being asked, would you like to pick cotton this year? And if you say, no, I would prefer not to pick cotton, you may be asked, well, could you give me $50 or could you pay me $100 because now I need to go and find somebody else. So there is a incentive to ask the wrong people to pick cotton. And I think one of the reasons why this may be happening, if indeed, as Umida says, there is no public call for these institutions or these staff to go and pick cotton, one of the reasons is that many of the heads of institutions, many of people in positions of power, take the opportunity to ask people for money. And that money is not going into some central fund for paying other cotton pickers. It typically goes to the pockets of the person asking. And I think that is really a problem that we're working with the government to tackle. And it's you could argue that it is not a labor issue, but it is more a corruption issue. But the fact is that it still would be classified as forced labor. You basically, there is a negative consequence if you decline the invitation to pick.
Okay.
So I think we should not underestimate that as a driving factor for, even though the central government has clearly said that many of these institutions should not be involved in the harvest, I believe that an explanation for why it may still be happening in some cases is that there are people who benefit from continuing asking the wrong people if they would be interested in picking.
Yeah, thank you very much. Let me bring in Bruce. Bruce, your general views on this. I kind of recall our last conversation, which was like almost a year ago, remembering that we were almost talking about the same things here. So what is your view based on what we discussed, specifically about the forced labor aspect of this issue? What did change and what did not change so far?
Well, you know, I mean, the Uzbek government's taken to, like, shifting people around. You know, there was those complaints 10 years ago that they were using child labor in the field. So those complaints were proved to be sufficient pressure that the government changed that and ended up putting, you know, teachers and accountants and, you know, different people like that out in the field, and essentially the parents of the children at the end of the day. You know, and then people said, well, this is still forced labor. It's good that it's not child labor. That's progress. So, but you still are telling people, doctors, that the they have to go out in the field and pick cotton and stuff. So now they've moved beyond that, and they're using soldiers and policemen and and people who are working with the state and law enforcement agencies and stuff to go out into the fields and pick cotton. So, you know, the forced labor, I don't know how much it's decreased. It seems to have been less than it was 10 years ago, but it's still there. They just keep going to different groups and making them do it once they hear, you know, complaints from international organizations, especially the ones that are buying clothing, individual governments, you know, okay, no child labor, we did that. Okay, well, no, don't put teachers and doctors out in the field. Okay, well, we won't do that. You know, so now they've just moved to different groups to go out and do the labor.
So teachers and doctors are not there. Is it what you are?
I haven't seen very many reports of that at all, you know, to tell you the truth. Some, but not, I mean, in previous years, they were everywhere that they were going out. Like I said, some are still there, but the bulk of the people seem to be, you know, like I said, men in uniform. And we did see that video that was released just a couple of weeks ago, the police just walking out. It was stunning to see that, you know, and Jonas is right that you probably wouldn't have seen something like that. I mean, that shows that people are willing to get this out, but it was an amazing video to watch all those policemen just walking out of the building and standing in the courtyard as a sign of protest.
Is it you are reporting that there is no teachers, there is no doctors this year, and there is no children this year?
Well, classes are going on in the schools. We didn't receive complaints like it was previous years that we don't have classes and teachers are gone and so on. So I would say that teachers and kids are not sent to cotton fields. But just adding Lazis,
based on what you are saying, that they are not sent to the fields, how do we know?
Because we are not receiving any reports from teachers, schools, and kids, or their parents, like it was a few years ago and last year even. Because, you know, the beginning of cotton season and the beginning of studies in school starts almost the same time. And previous years, we were receiving a lot of hundreds of reports, especially from parents of those kids, that our kids are just kept in schools and no classes are taking place, and some of their like tables or whatever, the chairs are taken and they don't even have chairs and so on. But this year we are not receiving reports like that.
Okay, so it's really a good conversation. Thank you very much for your frank comments. And again, I would have really enjoyed the presence of the Uzbek official in the discussion. We will keep trying to have them on the show. However, in the absence of them today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by Yunus Astrub, International Labor Organization's Chief Technical Advisor in Uzbekistan, Umida Niyazova, Director of Uzbek-German Forum for Human Rights, Laziz Omilov, journalist with Radio Free Arab Liberties Uzbek Service, where he runs a reporting project on Uzbekistan's cotton fields called Paxtagram, and Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C., and we are doing a reality check on forced labor in Uzbekistan's cotton fields. Welcome back. So on the working in the condition of accommodation of people, let me start with you, Umida, on this. So last year we had lots of reports about that, like horror stories, perhaps, including reports of injuries, deaths, in bad living conditions. How has it been so far this year?
Yeah, just a few days ago, one of our monitors, he went to pick cotton, and he met soldiers who were picking cotton in Jizak region, and one of the soldiers asked him to sell cotton to him. And when he asked why, he said that they have a daily norm, which is 100 kilogram, and this particular soldier, he said, I'm not able to pick this norm, so that's why he's buying cotton from the people who were there on the fields. And he said that they're so tired because of the cotton and not sleep well, and if they weren't able to again fulfill this norm, they can be punished. And I think just after the next day, Ozotlik reported that two soldiers were hit by a tractor and they died on the field. And I thought that this is not the war, this is just cotton harvest. But unfortunately, every year we recorded the deaths related to the cotton harvest.
Okay, let's listen to that from the source. Ozotlik, Laziz, you were earlier trying to say something on this in this context. So about the accidents, about the living conditions of people who were deployed to the cotton fields. How is this compared to the previous year?
Well, we keep receiving photos, videos, and on photos, on most of them, you can see that the pattern really didn't change, because people are still staying in partially in schools, port halls of schools. But when it comes to victims, just to add on what Umida said, Ozotlik received the report and actually eventually reported the same day that two army contractors, so basically those are not like the classical soldiers who serve for a year on compulsory conscription, but the contractors who come there for 1 month and just because they have to do that by law. And we have reports that those guys are also being sent to pick cotton forcibly. And two of them died because while they were on the cotton field, and they, as far as I know, they were having a nap, and the tractor just went over them, you know, the tractor with the cotton, and they actually died, both of them. We also have another report saying that Damas, like car carrying cotton pickers in Hojaili district of Karakalpakstan, collided with another car and crashed. The accident actually happened morning of 22nd September in front of Hojaili District Hospital. And officer from Khojaly District Police Department told RFRL that one person, 19-year-old man, was killed in crash and about 10 people were injured in that car, in both cars. When it comes to conditions, we also received a report from Kosan District, which says that the mayor of Kosan District, Asral Boykaraev, forced local businessmen from 111 state and private companies to buy gifts for cotton pickers. That document included such gifts as TVs, vacuum cleaners, refrigerators, and so on and so on. So basically, those reports that we see like on state press, which says that like some certain person hit a record and collected the biggest amount of cotton and they were given cars or something else or like refrigerators. So we received the actual document from the mayor of Kosan District, which is forcing those 111 organizations to somehow award those people.
Yeah, Bruce, you also monitor Uzbekistan's own media, and they are perhaps the one positive thing if can be said about this is that they are reporting about at least some aspect of these cotton harvest this year, and some of their reportings are rather more critical than compared to the last year. So how do you see the reporting on this issue on the local media? How is it compared to the last year?
Well, I mean, last year was already a jump. This year, I suppose they're progressed a little bit further. They do report on conditions, and when officials get caught trying to force people into the fields, in some cases, they do single out these people and say this person was caught trying to force them, and this is ridiculous. It's not supposed to happen, and they also have some reporting about to remind people that they shouldn't be forced into the field, and they can complain to the authorities if someone is forcing them into the field. So I mean, they're kind of coming at it from both sides. They work at not only trying to uncover some of this, although not hugely energetically. I mean, I wouldn't compare it with Azad Lik, for instance, but they do report on some of these instances of forced labor. And then they also, again, they remind people that from time to time that this shouldn't be happening anyway. And if officials are trying to force people into the field, then they should do that. That said, though, you also get the other side of it, too, where there's a campaign to make it look like it still is kind of an obligation. The head of the Women's Committee, for instance, said there was nothing wrong with women going out into the field and picking some cotton and making a little extra money, if they had to. So, and last year, we remember that there were celebrities that went out and I don't know how they were in the cotton field for at least a few minutes, long enough to be filmed, trying to show that, it's great to be outside and everyone should pitch in and help out with this. So, you get some of that, too, where it's also not on the level it was in the early days of like a patriotic duty, but almost like like a pastime that you can enjoy if you have free time. Why not go out and help out, pick cotton, help the country, help your friends, meet new people, kind of that stuff. Yeah. But certainly you wouldn't have seen that in the media 3 or 4 years ago at all, any of these things.
Yeah, this is how the Uzbek media reports about this, which is certainly a change there. Yunus, aside from the media, Uzbek media is reporting on this, some of the other problematic aspects, like in terms of the incidents, in terms of the living conditions that Laziz and Omida are talking about, Uzbek authorities promised to make these changes. How they explain the lack thereof?
Well, look, I think, first of all, in terms of the cases, there are lots of cases being mentioned. And I just want to clarify that we, as the ILO, Third Party Monitoring Project, we certainly also follow Usud Lik and the Uzbek Durban Forum and other organizations. And we report these cases to the feedback mechanism of the Ministry of Labor.
Right.
So there is a hotline mm-hmm. that people can contact either by phone or mm-hmm. by Telegram, which is a popular messaging app like WhatsApp is used in the West more, but here it's Telegram, and people can use that to report cases. And we have full access to the tracking software for these cases, and I can tell you that there has been over 1,000 cases reported already this year. It's interesting, to talk about individual cases, but there is no, I think, contradiction between what the kind of conversations that we have with the government about this, because we track these cases, we follow them individually, and this particular case with the soldiers, for example, is under investigation. That particular case is not under the jurisdiction of the Ministry of Labor, but we have a special channel for those type of cases, and that is being investigated as we speak. So I don't necessarily see a contradiction between, you know, talking about cases.
We are not. My intention was not to, you know, put you in the opposite side of the room to argue on this. But what I'm saying is, like, you know, when you raise these issues with the authorities there, how they explain, because they promised to you to change these practices, and you reported about these things to them. So how they respond, the lack of change there?
Yes, look, I mean, I think there are a lot of initiatives going on, and I can tell you that one thing that I see is every time a case is reported to the authorities, they do investigate, typically within 24 hours, but in some cases 48 hours. I don't think it's a question of explaining why something had happened. I think it's a question of investigating, finding out who, what is really going on, who is the perpetrator, and make sure that there is a sanction, there is a punishment of anybody, you know, who is breaking the rules. So those are really the kind of conversations that I have every day with government officials.
Okay. Omida, I saw on your website that you were reporting about the detention or the intimidation of a couple of bloggers and journalists, and you think there's a connection between cotton harvest. So tell us, please, who they are and why you think there's a connection between them.
Yes, for example, Maluhata Shankulova, the human rights activist who also was openly participated in the ILO events, she temporarily left Uzbekistan because she's afraid of being arrested. The authority opened the criminal case against her for the video she posted on YouTube. Another human rights activist from Khwarezm region, again, he was sentenced today, actually, on the probation, term, on 2 years, 3 months, for just having one book in his smartphone, which the expertise found that there is a religious extremism in this book. But this book actually is openly available on the internet. So unfortunately, this kind of repression, I would say, against human rights activists, they have a very bad effect to the others. Now, during the harvest time, no Maluhat, no Mahmoud, they can't monitor the situation because they're dealing with these criminal charges against them.
Okay. Lizzie, you know, last year, authorities were also chasing your contributors in Uzbekistan, pinpointing them and take punitive measures against them. I'm talking about those who would send you images, reports, or pictures. How is this year?
Well, I would come back to all this praising the digital media, because if before it was sort of controllable and they could control that, now, well, basically people are just shooting it, sending it to us and deleting that, and then keep saying we don't know anything, or they are just coming up like by groups, like police officers did that. They don't want to, of course, unveil themselves and open their identities and show their faces. But as you could see, again, in this video with police officers, in most of the cases, they are just making the photos at the cotton field, and we keep chatting with them, you know, to make sure they are there. Yes, they say that every time when they report something from that district, let's say if we give the reports from Jizzak area, from certain district, after our report, some people come and start talking to them, or the leader of the team starts talking to them and saying you shouldn't do that and don't send it to anyone, otherwise you could lose your job and so on. So when I said that there is pressure to a certain level, I meant this because people are still being pressured and they are being threatened with their jobs, especially when it's a state job, like police, firefighters, and national guards. The case we in Bukhara, for example, where one third of the whole firefighters team in the region was sent to cotton field to pick the cotton. They cannot talk much, but we are happy that people are getting brave and they are reporting now. And if they are not sending videos, they are ready to collaborate and to just to prove that they are really being sent there.
Are you getting more reports this year? Because you are talking about the bravery of people, like in terms of talking to you, in terms of reacting to the authorities. I mean, are you getting more reports, more images this year compared to the last year? How is that compared?
Well, to tell you the truth, it's quite difficult to tell you whether it's more or less, because the amount, the volume is pretty much huge, like it was last year and before. But when I'm saying that they are getting brave, we would never receive the video of police officers openly walking out, for example, you know, or in most of the cases, for example, people would just report you quickly by text and they would disappear or just delete their account in Telegram and open it again in some other ways. But this time they are like sending messages, and of course we answer them and we start some small investigations, and we ask them to make the photos, like for example with their fingers on the cotton field, and they do photos, and they even send the photos of themselves, but they are asking just please blur our faces, you know, we just want to make everyone to see that we are actually here. Or another very prominent case, I'm sorry for keep coming back to police officers, but when this was reported first time, actually the Ministry of Interior of Uzbekistan came back to this and they actually refused all those reports, saying that it didn't happen, after which actually those police officers made a video. And after that statement, when they denied the Ministry of Interior, we had hundreds of reports from police officers on cotton fields sending us the photos and saying, well, we are not lying to you, we are actually right here, and now we want you to give our photos. And we started just blurring their photos and giving, you know, like publishing them.
Yeah, it's interesting. Bruce, let me bring you in here. Compared to the last year, if there's one change, that change is the social media dynamics of it. I mean, the way things just quickly gets out to public. How do you see this is affecting all this cotton campaign, the authorities' calculation, how to manage all this?
Well, you know, I mean, clearly it's having an effect. I wouldn't say it's so much more dramatic this year than last year. More, yes, and more also because of the sort of people who are out in the field. You know, naturally, if you're a school teacher or something like that, or, you know, an accountant, you're going to be a little bit shy about sending this information. But if you're a soldier, if you're a policeman or something, then effectively you are the law at that point, and you probably feel a little more confident about sending that out. So I don't think it's so much the medium as it is the people that are out there, and that's why you're getting more of this year than you were last year, if there is that much of an increase. That's what I would ascribe it to.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of referring to, Bruce. Like, you know, this year you are getting these leaked audios from different meetings, which would put the authorities in discussion really in a bad situation. Like, you know, it certainly applies to the cotton campaign too. You've been getting these audios from the, let's say, Fergana governor's meeting when he's lambasting the young people with beards and women with hijab and all these things. Certainly it has some sort of effect on the way the authorities are trying to manage the cotton campaign.
Yeah, well, obviously, and like I said, they're much more aware of the fact that people might have phones on them. I think, you know, they're getting a little more accustomed to having to make sure that people don't have these things when they're going to go after them anymore. So it's something they have to take in consideration. In the past, they would have just let loose. Yeah. You know, hit them, screamed at them, whatever. But now they have to at least think, you know, that maybe they have a phone or something. Maybe it's being recorded, you know. And again, so first you remove that.
Yeah.
Once you remove the phone, then we're back at the situation we had 10 years ago.
Yeah. Unfortunately. Omida, quickly. Huh?
Yes. No, just wanted to say that this year there was only one audio recording from the Hakim's meeting in Khwarezm region, where he scolds people and demands everyone to be sent to Pikatan. And the labor inspection then punished this official for using forced labor. Also to point that, yes, this inspectorate of Ministry of Labor is actively responding to the media reports about the forced labor, primarily to publication by Radio Ozotlik. But sometimes, and I would say oftenly, when they come to the organizations after the arrival, workers write statements that they're picking cotton voluntarily, or they write a statement to Ozotlik, ask them to remove the complaint.
Yeah, that's interesting. You and us, I'm sure you confront the authorities with with these kind of allegations. But also, you know, in the other countries, like especially where I'm sitting in Washington, D.C., so there is a kind of certain procedure, certain laws to protect whistleblowers, like the ones who leak these kind of audios. So is there any work taking place on that aspect to protect those reporters, those people who leak these kind of wrongdoing of the authorities?
Well, this is a key part of the investigation techniques that's used by the authorities. So we do, I'm certainly not saying that we have reached a stage of perfection yet, but we are training labor inspectors with human rights activists, in fact, on investigation techniques on forced labor, how to investigate child labor and forced labor. And one of the key principles there, as you pointed out, is to protect people. Make sure that you don't put people in a more difficult situation than you found them. And this is a fundamental principle, you know, also one that we observe in our monitoring, to be very careful about disclosing people's identities and so on. You need to be careful about that. I think there is definitely an effort to not only investigate the case and report back and punish perpetrators, but also to ensure afterwards to come back and follow up and ensure that people are not being punished for reporting cases. So we are definitely seeing that. I'm personally not aware of any whistleblower that has been punished. If anybody is aware of a case like that, I would love to know about it, and so would the authorities, and we would immediately make sure that there's the follow-up.
Yeah, the thing that Umeda was saying about, there's a certain fear factor here. I mean, when people first report and then they try to withdraw those reports, clearly there's a risk, perhaps a punitive element involved. These things come out of fear of some sort, right?
Well, it's difficult for me to answer sort of a very general question like that. Of course, what motivates people to do certain things? But I mean, of course, this is exactly why it is so important that people feel comfortable speaking up. And we do see, as we talked about earlier, that there is certainly an increase in people's willingness to raise issues and to complain. Okay. But if somebody says to you that they would like to withdraw a statement, or that they asked Osudik to take down their name or their photo, it's difficult to deal with if people are you know, perceiving a risk and they ask for things to be taken down.
Yeah. But anyway, so really, it's a really good discussion that we are having today, but unfortunately we need to end it. But let's do it with final points. Umeda, you've been monitoring this. I believe some of your colleagues went to Uzbekistan and had a discussion with the Uzbek authorities about plans they have on how to change that. And, you know, I don't know what's being discussed in Tashkent, but again, when the Uzbek authorities would come to Washington, D.C., they would also have, you know, big speeches about their projects and plans on how they are trying to eradicate this question. But one of that is they would say that Uzbek authorities are planning to take off their hands from this sector. Have you seen any steps being taken in this direction?
There are a lot of promises. Just recently, there was a strategy on reforming our culture sector was announced, and we listen a lot of promises, but I will say that we are, as a human rights activist, as a human rights organization, we're reporting what is happening now. So when people complaining to us, when we see and record that the people's rights should be defended, protected, then we report about this. So it's too early to conclude what will happen after this cotton harvest. We will continue to evaluate the results of the current situation, and at the end we will do it the objectively and honest conclusion.
Right. Let me take, Bruce, your point on that. I mean, what I was trying to refer is, I mean, Uzbek authorities would say in a way that they will just let the cotton sector run itself, like just take off their hands, authorities, I'm saying. And also authorities were talking about to diversify the agriculture sector. Have you seen any changes taking place in these two points, that the promises that they made?
Well, I mean, they've been making the promises. I believe the latest one is like next year is supposed to be the last year they export raw cotton or something, right? That was the latest promise. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do that anymore. We're going to export textiles after that. You know, it's a vital part of their economy. They got to get it out. Clearly, they would make more money if they were doing textiles, but that still means somebody's got to pick the cotton out of the field. You know, they promised in the past that we're going to have more mechanized farming, but I haven't seen, although Jonas is there, so maybe he's seen it, but I haven't seen that much progress toward that. And you know, the thing that concerns me is that we know this was entrenched in in the system. I mean, it dates back to the Soviet days and possibly even further than that. But so we already know about people having to go out there. But, you know, we're coming up on the 3-year anniversary of President Mirziyoyev's election, and he's been pounding on this for a long time. And yet some officials in areas don't seem to be getting the message. And that's what's confusing to me, is I don't understand, you know, given how vehemently and clearly he's been articulating this, that we're not going to put up with it and you can't do it, but yet it persists in some areas. So I'm still kind of wondering if he gets in front of the camera and says one thing, and then they all meet in a closed room somewhere, and he says, whatever you do, whatever it takes to meet the target figure, the quota, you make sure you do it, understanding that if you get caught abusing people or sending people out, we're going to disown you and you're going to end up being punished.
That's a very interesting point. Jonas, please feel free to add something if you would like.
Yes.
But also, Bruce referred to another very important point, a mechanization of the cotton harvest. And we have seen authorities after authorities from Tashkent would come to Washington, D.C., and would go to visit all these major factories where machines would be produced, like agriculture machines, harvesting machines, and they would talk about it, that they would like to change the way the cotton is planted, the way the cotton is harvested. Any changes, specific changes, have taken place since last year in this front?
Yeah, well, look, I think it's clear that mechanization is part of the solution, but it's certainly a long-term solution. Currently, about 5% of the cotton is being harvested by machine. Hmm. The government has issued a strategy for moving that forward, but it's going to take at least a decade to have a significant part of the harvest mechanized. And this is because it's not as simple as simply buying some nice John Deere machines and then put them in the fields. You have to prepare the fields in a certain way, and the variety of cotton needs to be of a certain kind. This is something which is moving along, and over time, it will certainly be a big help. But I don't think there's anybody today that's pretending that this is going to be a short-term, quick fix. I must say, I am optimistic about the future here. And one of the reasons that I'm optimistic is that the government issued, it was out for public consultation a few weeks ago, and now it's finalized. The agricultural strategy has been announced. And there are two very important dates in that strategy. Oh. By 2021, the quota system will be abolished. And by 2023, the entire state order system will be abolished. So the problem today, and the reason that we are still having these conversations, is that there is a focus on quantity rather than value. And so when the farmers need financing for their production inputs, like their fertilizers, their seeds, their labor, whatever they need financing for, they can't go to the private banks because there's simply not enough capital in the private banking system. So the government offers financing for production inputs at a very low interest rate. But that financing comes with a production target currently. So if the farmer borrows, I'm making an example, $1,000, he needs to produce X tons of cotton. And this is what is also known as the quota system.
Right.
That system will be phased out by 2021. The other factor here is that currently the government, and this happens in many countries, by the way, has a plan for which crops need to be grown. So, in other words, the farmers don't have total freedom to decide which crops they are growing. Hmm. That system, this is also known that the state order system, will be abolished by 2023. I really believe that when we see these systems change, and as we move to increased textile and garment manufacturing, where full-time, year-round jobs can be created in factories, manufacturing and processing, I think these are the kind of solutions that will significantly change this. At this stage, we need investors to come to Uzbekistan. We need responsible investors who have a track record of putting in place, decent working conditions in factories, in processing plants. We need investors that are open to having conversations about social standards, about labor standards. And I really must say that I think this is the biggest contribution that the world can make to solve this problem, is to look at Uzbekistan as a sourcing destination and as an investment destination.
Okay, so for investors.
Yeah, that's right. May I just add something?
Quickly, please.
I totally agree that Uzbekistan needs international investors. So that's why Uzbekistan must demolish the system of forced labor as soon as possible.
Right. Bruce, anything to add in this? And just the final comments here?
I think we all mentioned a few times, we got to wait a couple of weeks weeks and see what happens when carver season ends, what all came out of this. But certainly an interesting conversation so far, and a lot of reason for hope that wasn't there just a year or two ago.
Right. Laziz, final point from you?
Well, while it's important to say that, yes, there is certain progress taking place, and we are seeing less teachers and less people being forced and so on, but at the same time, we can say that the system of forcing people and state employees to pick a cotton is also developing. Not only digital media is developing for people themselves, but the system is also developing. And just to add on, we had the cases when these state employees, I just forgot to tell you about when these state employees were forced to change their clothing, uniforms, so that people cannot see that they are working for state and so on. But generally, I have to say, yes, there is certain level of progress, but we cannot say that forced labor is eradicated in Uzbekistan and that it decreased significantly. It's still taking place, and we believe that for that there can be systematic, some system issues, and also the fact of history that people are honestly frightened for, like we're frightened for last 25 years to tell to government that they don't want to go to pick cotton, or just to be a little bit brave. I think there are a lot of combined reasons for that.
Okay, so let me add my point. For me, now it's been 3 years since, I hear Uzbek authorities would like to join us on the podcast, and every year we try to bring them on. So for me, I would like to see them actually deliver on what they say. So let's see how it goes next year. With this, thank you very much, Jan Astrup, International Labor Organization's Chief Technical Advisor in Uzbekistan, Umida Niyazova, Director of Uzbek German Forum for Human Rights, Laziz Omilov, Journalist with Araf Yarel's Uzbek Service, and Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia, Blog Kishlok, Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.